Hello everyone, and welcome to the Phidias Club. This is episode 83 for February 2017, Civilized Conversations and Wrong Decisions. Hello everyone, and welcome back to the Phidias Club. This is episode 83, I believe, and we're in February 2017. My name is Patrick Beja, and in this show we get people from different parts of the world, different cultures, different outlooks on life, politics, the economy, ecology, everything, and we get together and discuss them and see whether or not we can find out a little bit of common ground and wisdom in this big global community that we'll build together. So today we have two guests. The first one I'm sure you know already. It's Tom Merritt, who's coming from the west coast of the United States. How are you doing, Mr. Merritt?
Yes, I'm coming from the Independent Republic of Los Angeles.
I didn't realize that had gone through yet. I thought it was still in secret preparation.
Yeah. Sometimes it feels like it. Sometimes it doesn't.
Well, thank you either way for waking up at this really early hour to be on the
of
show
course.
With us.
I wouldn't miss it, Patrick. Thanks for inviting me again.
I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say, because it's you're usually... Well, we'll get to it towards the end of the show. We'll get to it. So let's not spoil the topic. And so for those who don't know, I'm in France. And so we always have to contend with this huge collection of different time zones. And it's often a little bit difficult to put together, but we usually manage. And the other guest is pretty close to me, so that's not too complicated this time. Franco is coming to us from Spain. How are you doing, sir?
I'm fine, thank you. And yes, we have the same time zone, although I'm willing to argue that we should have another time zone, mainly London's one. But that's a whole different story, I guess. Okay.
Well, yeah, for me, I mean, I was actually 2 days ago in St. Petersburg. Wait, 2 days ago? Yes, 2 days ago I was in St. Petersburg. Yesterday I was in Helsinki, and today I'm in Paris. And that was an interesting trip, by the way, in St. Petersburg. I was there for about a week, and it's not the first time I've been in Russia, but it's a pretty different, interesting, contrasting place. I would love to do a show about Russia specifically at some point, not just because, you know, it's in the news, it's been in the news a lot recently, but really it's a fascinating place, and they have an outlook that is so different on the world than we do. And I could launch into a whole discussion now, but I won't, because this is not the topic of this show. So two things maybe about Russia. There were lots of amazing places and museums and culture. And the other aspect of it is that the pavement on the roads that had been redone like 10 years ago was already completely uneven and broken. So it's like, you know, it's pretty like, almost a century of communism will do funny things to society. There's a definite feeling, maybe it's wrong, and maybe some Russian listeners are going to come on the comments section of the blog and yell at me for saying this, but there's this feeling that people don't care about doing their job well. And that's incredibly inflammatory, possibly, but it's like the trend that I feel there. It's like, I could tell you stories about hotels I've been to and I've had like problems with air conditionings, and the way they fixed it was like, what are you doing? Like shoving, anyway,
was it duct tape? It's always duct tape.
Worse than duct tape. Like shoving a towel inside the duct, like with a broomstick, like shoving it as far as possible to block the air from coming in. And the guy was like, yep, fixed. All right, cool. Excellent. And I was like, what? What? It was... And at the
That's
same
That's called
time,
an efficient use of resources.
Uh-huh. I suppose so. Anyway, so that was that was really interesting. And I saw, you know, a couple of expos that were amazing. Like the culture there is incredible, and there's a pride. And anyway, really interesting city, really interesting country. The other thing I wanted to say before we start the show is that last episode, as usual, well, as usual, got a really positive feedback and a somewhat hesitant feedback. I think there were a few people who were saying it was really difficult for them to listen to because there was a lot of things they were disagreeing with and things that they couldn't really understand. And it got me thinking a lot about the reasons why I do these episodes specifically, where I go out of my way to invite people that I vehemently disagree with and still listen to them when sometimes I think what they're saying is, you know, wrong. Maybe sometimes if I let myself go, I would say it's even dangerous to go that route politically and these kinds of things. And I put up a post on the Patreon page for those who are patrons of mine. You've already seen it. And I'm not going to repeat all of it. It was a long video. But essentially what it came down to was the reason I do it is that, first of all, there are let's look at the alternative. And the alternative is, you'll never listen to what the actual people have to say, and you'll never hear it. And of course, you're going to disagree 90% of the time or 80% of the time. And that's the case, you know, for liberals and Republicans and all walks of life, if we're not talking about the US. We're going to disagree a lot of the time. But if we agree, or if we see their point of view, and, you know, whether they see mine or I see theirs, or listeners see the other person's point of view 10% of the time, that's something that doesn't happen if those exchanges don't exist. So, of course, there are lines. I think, you know, there are, if something goes over the line, I'm not willing to invite just anyone to discuss things. If we're going to start talking about, you know, racism and homophobia, I'm not going to invite someone to say, to explain to me why they think black people should be killed, for example, you know, if we're going to the extremes. That's not something I want to discuss, but we're not, I really don't think we're there. And in those not there situations, those moments, those rare moments around the anger and the rage and the fury of what you're hearing, again, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on, those moments between that, when you're thinking, not even agreeing, but at least thinking, oh, so that's why they think that. I still disagree, but at least I understand how they came to that conclusion that seemed so alien to me before. Well, those moments are precious, and those moments don't exist if we don't even listen to one another. So I just want to, you know, it's not so different from what I usually say about the show, but I wanted to mention it here specifically because of that last episode, which was got that those kinds of reactions. So hopefully you understand where I'm coming from, and hopefully you get some value out of those discussions.
If I may, Patrick, it is one of the reasons that I think the show is so important and why I love it and why I tell people to listen to it, because now more than ever, we need to listen and understand to people we disagree with.
You know, I've been talking about this in France as well, because as you know, we have an election coming, the presidential election, and the Front National, which is the extreme right-wing party, is very, very popular. And we have a lot of reactions that are, I'm going to, again, talk about it. And we have a lot of reactions that are eerily similar to what we had in the UK during the Brexit campaign and in the US during the presidential campaign. And I'm trying to tell people who are, you know, on my social networks, etc., I'm trying to tell them, it's not about the racism or homophobia that are probably part of the sentiment that fuels those parties. What's important is to listen to the people who are voting for those parties and to understand why they're going to those extremes. I don't think we have, like, there's 25-30% of people who are going to vote for the Front National in the latest polls. I don't think there are 30% of people who are actively racist and homophobic. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I really don't believe that. I think there are, as we've heard when we talk to people, you know, on the Brexit camp and on the Trump camp, or, you know, on the fence, there are different reasons for this. And the irony is that those those reasons, at least in those two examples, were often fueling people on both sides of the extreme. In France, it's also getting the extreme left a boost, a surprising boost. It's almost, you know, not quite communism, but it's a step further from socialism as well. So, and I'm telling them, we have to listen. And the act of telling people you have to listen seems like something unconscionable, because it's like you're doing the apology of, I don't know if you can use that word in that context in English, like you're justifying racism. And I'm like, no, that's not what I'm doing. And I get yelled at on Twitter.
It's true that, Patrick, it's true that if you invite someone to your show, it's as if you give it a little bit of credibility, right? And that's, I think that goes along with what you were saying, that you wouldn't invite anyone regardless of what they think, because right, because it's if they're part of the discussion, it means that they have that, or you or someone gives them a little bit of credibility. Or
I completely agree, but I do think that there's this blanket image of voters who are going the way of the Front National, who are racist and homophobic, and that's it, and we shouldn't talk to them. You know, some people, that's what they think. And if I guess if you actually believe that they're all racist and homophobic, then I understand the sentiment. But I don't think we understand why they're going to the Front National. Sure, there are elements of, you know, xenophobia and nationalism. But as the irony is that every time we have had a big political upheaval or social upheaval in our history, maybe I'm overstating it a little bit, but it's been economics that were at the core of the issue. You know, the people were not happy with their economic situation, and we had a destruction of the middle class and the, not a destruction, but anyway, that's a whole other conversation. But I think racism and homophobia and intolerance are elements, but they're not the core.
Yeah, it's true that if people usually, when they vote for a party, they don't vote for all of the things that the party represents. They usually have, they share more with that party than with the others, right? And if not, we would have a party for every citizen. And it's true that everyone has its own part that they like. And it's true that the Front National has just recently this last year have had this amazing growing of voters, and France has always had the Front National, or from a lot of time ago, and that doesn't mean that all of a sudden they decided that they share all their beliefs. It's just that there's probably part of the message that goes into them, and the other parties that they just want to reject the other parties.
There's a lot of that for sure. And you know, I'm not saying there is no component that is racist or xenophobic, or of course there is, like far right, clearly there's going to be some of that. But it's the other part that is important to understand and to talk to, because if you don't, if you say, I don't want to talk to you, then they're going to stay there. They're just going to say, well, all right, F you too, and I'm going to keep voting for the Front National. And for me, the biggest issue there is the nationalistic aspect, which wants to take us out of the European Union, who wants to go back to the franc and not use the euro anymore. It's all of those things that are economically horrible, economically and socially horrible, in my view, and that I don't want policy-wise. You know, it almost doesn't matter whether or not they're, you know, Nazis and racists, and of course that's a part of it. But the real problem is that what they want to do is going to be bad for my country, even beyond the xenophobic aspects. I don't want to get out of the EU. I think that would be a grave mistake. We're all the time, you know, they're talking about the negative aspects of what happens when you're part of a union. And sure, there are some negative aspects, I'm sure, but the positive aspects far outweigh them for me. And that's, anyway, all right, we started talking about France, so let's keep doing that. I guess, one of the big pieces of news was the assault of a young guy from the suburbs by cops that happened a few weeks ago, and I'm sure some of you of the listeners have heard about it. And there's been basically there was one young black man who was stopped for a routine check by cops, and they became violent, and there was like one of them actually made him, and I'm sorry, this is very graphic, he made him take his pants down and inserted his stick into his anus. He was basically raped. And obviously that was a huge scandal. And I think it's kind of akin to the scandals you've had in the U.S. in recent years in the cases of police violence, except, well, you know, we don't have as many guns, so it's not the same result, however horrible it is. And there's been a lot of discussion of the role of police and the dangers therein, because there are also big issues in that sense. Some places they don't really dare to go to anymore. When they do, they get their cars get attacked and all of those things. And I think the thing that struck me was that even though it did create some, you know, a little bit of rioting and a little bit of protest, overall, the reactions from the political personalities seemed to me pretty grounded. They were saying both, you know, this instance of police brutality is unacceptable and very firmly condemning it and saying, but, you know, the judges have to work in a serene environment, and they're going to do their job, and we're going to let justice work. And at the same time, we shouldn't forget the conditions they're working in, and, you know, seeing all sides of the issues, which I'm not sure I see when I hear about these things in some other countries, maybe specifically in the US, but maybe that's because I'm too far from it. So it's sort of quieted down a little bit and being taken over by the elections, which I'm going to talk about in a second. But was wondering if you guys had heard about this incident.
Yeah. And what's interesting in your description of it is the impression that I got in reading about it in the United States was that you had lots of riots and there was not a feeling of calm about it, and that it was in its reaction very similar to, like you say, the various police brutality incidents in the United States. I didn't feel like it was presented as any different, to be honest, just maybe less common, but not in and of itself very different. And your description of the reactions is exactly the same as the description of the reactions here. President Obama at the time, had a reaction of, you know, please, you know, let the judges do their work. Let's let justice take its course. There were a lot of those exact same political reactions and various reactions from the populace, some saying, yes, you know, peaceful protest, and others saying, no, we need to push farther. And then eventually decisions are handed out and there is both, you know, anger and resentment and justification for those decisions. The quintessential difference is that it is less common in the U.S. for there to be a police brutality incident where there is not a shooting under field conditions. So what happened in France, it sounded like to me, was something where a policeman took agency, right, and perpetrated something on someone, not in the heat of the moment necessarily.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas, and that happens in the United States. I'm not trying to say it doesn't. But the majority of the incidents that people think of, like in Ferguson and places like that, were a policeman operating under fear and shooting perhaps when they shouldn't have been shooting. And then that's what the entire judicial review is about. What was this an appropriate use of force? So there's a couple of differences there. But I think those differences, while interesting, are less important than the reactions aren't because of the details per se. They are because of built-up frustration and mistrust between the government and law enforcement and the community they're policing.
Yeah, and I think maybe I'm understating the riots a little bit. It's not like it was like three people in the street for a day and then that was it. It was several days. It was violent incidents. So maybe it's a little bit more similar to what, you know, you guys have in the U.S. than I care to admit. I think the difference is, as you said, it's clear that no one can defend the policeman in this instance, whereas in the U.S., as you said, it's often, you know, under fear and you're not sure you did the right thing, but there was cause. In this case, obviously, there's no cause.
Yeah.
And also, we don't have as many of them, or at least that's how it feels. It happens every once, every few years, I guess, or, you know, the big ones that we hear about, whereas in the U.S., it feels like it's every few months that there's a shooting. And
yeah, but I think it goes with what you were saying, Patrick, that if everyone has guns, or if more people has guns, it's...
You're breaking up, Franco. Skype is evil. You're breaking up. You were saying if everyone has guns, then these kinds of things happen more.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Better.
Go ahead.
Or not? Okay. I was saying, yeah, if everyone has guns, it's, the police has to take, of course, immediate action or more reflex-based actions, I guess. It's because as soon as they see that the other person has a gun, or they suspect they have a gun, they have to, it's hard to I don't know, take it slowly or not overreact, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it. And whether or not people should have guns is not a debate we're going to launch into today. So the other thing I wanted to talk about is the election in France. And to try and describe to you very quickly the situation we're in at the moment, it's the presidential election happening in April and May. We have two rounds. And we have basically the right, the left, and the center. And on the right, we have Marine Le Pen, which is getting polls-wise the best numbers, which is already a frustration. That's the extreme right-wing party. The François Fillon is the traditional, what it's the Republican candidate, basically. And the irony in his candidacy is that he surpassed in the primaries other candidates because he was clean and because he didn't have any, you know, problems with the law. And ironically, he was accused now of having employed his wife and other people, his children, in fake jobs, which netted him and his family about €1 million over, I think, 10 or 15 years, something like that. And it developed over the past month or so, that story. And now he's still pretty strong. I think he's second, even though those issues have been made pretty clear. I mean, the justice system is still working through it. So I guess if you want to make sure you're neutral until you have a decision, you know, presumed innocent, but it's still weighing down on his campaign. And the reaction has been to sort of go after the press and talk about the fact that there's, you know, like trying to deflect with there's a state of civil war in the country and these kinds of inflammatory statements, which are transforming him from the stable, you know, rational right-wing candidate you can depend on into something a little bit less, you know, reliable, but still... he's still second in the polls. And then you have the left side of the aisle, which where it's like a tragedy in slow motion. You have the extreme left wing, which is one candidate who, as I was saying, could be considered on the verge of communism, but not quite. He's, let's say, socialist and not social democrat, but he's definitely a socialist, and he's attracting, I think, a lot of the people that are sick of the usual political scene, very much in the same way that Marine Le Pen with the Front National is doing, and very much in the same way that maybe Bernie Sanders or even Donald Trump, I think it was kind of the same attraction, got a big traction with the voters. And he was sort of part of the general left wing, but he's sort of splitting the vote for the left wing. And the other candidate is Hamon, who won the primaries in sort of a surprise with the primary process for the Socialist Party because he wasn't the favorite. And he represents a clear left turn on the Socialist Party. Basically, he's not trying to go the Social Democrat route, trying to be closer to the center, but he's clearly on the left, trying to do what a lot of people in France are calling the left, the socialist, have to do a real socialist policy and not try to go to the center and become social democrats, who in effect are the same thing as liberals. And that's a sentiment, as what we would call Republicans, what you guys would call Republicans. And I hope you're not hearing the work happening outside. So there's a little bit of noise here.
Not yet, no.
And so that's a sentiment that's very present here with the voters on the left who are very active, who are saying the previous government of Hollande, the one who is in place now, has betrayed what it said it would do, which was basically what the new candidate from the Socialist Party is now saying he will do, which is socialist policy. Not socialist in the sense of, you know, not on the, I know socialist as a word is very loaded for many people, including in the US, but it's not that far to the left. It's obviously you believe in the market economy, free market, etc., etc. It has more to do with the help the government is going to provide around different areas of society. And so a lot of people are saying, Hollande was elected on that platform. He went more to the right. We don't want that anymore. And the reason why all of these voters are going to the right wing, to the extreme right wing, is that we didn't get a real left wing policy in the country for decades. And now we have to stop messing around and we have to take care. In a sense, I don't think that's how they're saying it, but in essence, the issue everyone is trying to address without being able to call it that with that name is that the middle class is thinning out. And that's a huge problem. And that's where I'm, you know, going when I'm saying the economy is the cause of everything. We have people who have more money and people who have less money, and the middle class is sort of disappearing. And we don't know if we have to fix it with right-wing policies or left-wing policies, and both sort of say we have the answer, you know, and the people in the opposing side are saying, F you, you're going to destroy the world, which is full of, you know, nuance. But the result is that on the left side, you have two candidates, the semi-communist and the socialist, who have 10 to 15% of the votes, who could win if they got together, but they're not going to. And so they're not going to be on the second round. The right wing, the Republican, is still leading, but the center candidate, who used to be part of the government of Hollande, who is a left wing candidate, a left wing government, is now in the center trying to appeal to everyone. And he has his chances. It's getting pretty tight between the Republican and him to be on the second round against what is probably going to be Marine Le Pen. And when I see the reactions of people, because they're saying we don't want to vote for the Republican or for the center because he's going to be doing the same shit again and again that we've been doing for 20 years. I don't believe that, but that's what I'm hearing. And so I think they're going to abstain. I think a lot of them are going to abstain. And so the result of all of this long tirade is that I'm now way more worried that Marine Le Pen is going to get the election. And she's plagued by, you know, legal issues as well. But for some reason, the voters who vote for her don't care in the same way that the voters who voted for Trump didn't care. They're just like, F all of you. We don't care about, you know, we've had enough of all of you and we're going with her because she just, you know, runs like a truck and she's going to destroy everything in her path maybe, but she's just going to do it. And it's a very similar sentiment. And we're getting, calls of biased press and all of this. So I used to say when I was talking in the previous episodes that I was certain we were not going to get Marine Le Pen as a president. Now I'm less certain. I'm getting genuinely concerned.
Patrick, if you would have to whom do you think has more chances of winning Marine Le Pen in the second round? Is it the centrist Emmanuel Macron, or is it Fillon?
I think it's the centrist, yes, because he has no issues that we know of with the law.
So far.
He hasn't broken any laws so far. And on top of that, the left-wing side of the country has already voted for the right-wing side in 2002 against Jean-Marie Le Pen, which is Marine Le Pen's father. And at that point, they were like, okay, we don't like it, but we're going to do it to stop the Front National. I'm not sure enough of them will do it again this time. With the center candidate, they might do it more willingly. So,
yeah. I've been discussing also sorry, Tom.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was just going to say quickly, there's something different in the psychology of having a runoff, too, which we don't have in the United States. We sort of fake it by having primaries and then the general election. But there's something to feeling like, well, I voted for my person in that first round. And so I've done my duty, and now I can vote pragmatically in that second round.
But there's been so much. Another sentiment is that there's been so much of the pragmatic vote in the last two or three decades that people are sick of it. And people, the argument is, we keep voting pragmatically for someone we don't like, but to prevent someone else to get in power, and we don't want to do it anymore because the situation keeps getting worse and worse. And the argument is, we did that in 2002, and look what happens now, 15 years later, the Front National hasn't stopped gaining ground. Why? Because the policies of the successive governments that are not left-wing enough have made the situation worse and have put more people in poverty and has created more desperation that pushes people to the right wing, the extreme right wing. So that's not what I think, but that's the narrative that I think is very palpable here in the country. So, yeah.
Well, it's, you know, I think the underlying problem is when you're talking about the disappearance of the middle class and economics, it's not that the economy has been that bad lately. It certainly got very bad in the mid 2000s, right, because of the financial crisis. But it's that people don't feel like they have it as good as they used to, or how they perceive they used to, or how they perceive their parents used to. And especially in the United States, I know that's true, where the 50s is idolized as that post-war boom economy where everybody could afford a house and a family of four and the American dream, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you see people voting along the lines of take us back to that. That was appeal of Trump in the election. And I feel like it's not exactly the same. You can't say it's exactly the same with Le Pen, but she appeals to the idea of what's been going on hasn't worked. Maybe I might as well try someone who says something that sounds different for once.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, the EU is taking money from us and not giving us enough, a lot of what we heard in the Brexit, and like, we have to take back our sovereignty and we have to be able to decide for our own destiny, and this kind of, I would say, BS, because again, you're giving examples from the negative aspects of being in the union and not taking into account the positive aspects. But about the middle class, I think it's not so much that we're looking back and thinking, oh, we had it so much better. At least that's not the case in France. And I think in the US, your poverty might be worse than we have it here in France. But I think what people are looking at is looking at the gap between those who have a lot and those who don't. And the lower class might be more comfortable on, you know, absolute, when you look at it objectively, more comfortable than the middle or lower class was 30 years ago. I mean, if you look at modern comforts, the things that modern technology has brought everyone, you know, everyone has access to infinite knowledge, and we have easy transportation for everywhere. We can go anywhere relatively cheaply. If you live in France, save enough, you can go to Japan, you know, even if you're relatively poor. It's not impossible unless you're like the poorest of the poorest. But when you look at those who have a lot, whether it's true or not, you feel like it wasn't as that there wasn't as much of a difference a few years ago and or a few decades ago. And that's why what I mean by the importance of the middle class. It doesn't matter that you're lower class has food and shelter and entertainment. What matters is that in a society, you need to have a unified, a big middle class so that you have social, you know, cohesion.
No, I think that it needs to be fair. And it's not only needs to be fair, the system, but the people have to see it's fair. And it happens everywhere. If you are working in a company and you're getting paid well, but the guy next to you is doing what you think is the same work and it's getting paid double, then you're going to feel bad either way, even though you're getting what you need to get paid. It's the sentiment of you're not being treated the same, and the system is favoring people. Even though everything goes into fairness and the sensation that you're not being treated as fairly or seen through the same eyes if the rules are fair, then you don't want to play.
There, right? Yeah, exactly. And all there right. Sorry, Tom.
Oh, no, I looked it up. INSEE statistics in 2016 for France put the poverty level to about 14.1%. And the latest I could find from the U.S. is 2014, but that was 14.5%. So poverty levels are about equivalent in both countries. And I remember, and I can't find that citation right off the top of my head, but I remember there was a study that showed that people in the below the poverty line were not voting or supporting right-wing candidates. It was people above the poverty line. And I think that bears out what you guys are saying, which is it's a belief that the system isn't working for you. If you're below the poverty line, I feel like the psychology may be the system has never worked for me, so I'm going to vote for someone I believe wants to help poor people. Whereas if you're above the poverty line, you may think, well, the system used to work for me, but for years now, I've been saying this is my frustration and the government does nothing.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, there's this sentiment that is definitely part of it. And I remember there was an experiment that was really interesting in people. It was basically a social experiment where you would give one person $100 and tell them you can keep however much you want and you will give the rest to someone else. And then that second person can decide whether or not they will receive the money or just cancel the deal altogether and no one gets anything. And when you went below a certain amount that you would give the second person, then that second person would just cancel it every time. Uh-huh. It'd be just because of fairness, right? They were like, intuitively, you would be like, yeah, but you're getting, you know, $30. You would get nothing otherwise, and people don't care. The inherent sentiment of fairness is important, and the really interesting thing to me is that whether you're in France, in socialist France, or in in the U.S., whoever you are, your opinion of policies is always the way of redistributing health. Wealth, I'm sorry. Redistributing well, wealth and health as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, whether you think capitalism is the way to go and it's like, if you deserve it, you know, you have to work and we'll decide how we redistribute that wealth to depending on people who work the hardest, or whether you say, well, we should redistribute a certain amount to everyone so that everyone can afford the basic needs. It's some people usually think that the two are completely opposite on a base philosophical level. I think everyone wants to redistribute wealth. It's just how to go about it. I've taken up way too much time. So that's where we are here in France, and I'm more worried than I was before.
I don't want to take pleasure in the fact that you were saying that France had grown-ups discussing things at one point in your election cycle. Do you still feel that way?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, good. Good to know.
It is definitely, it's, you know, not as good as I would like it to be.
Sure.
But when I look at the difference between the way things are happening in the U.S. and the way things are happening in France, there's no comparison. There's definitely the grown-ups and the angry children. Sorry if that hurts anyone's feelings, but that's the way it feels.
Yeah, so. You can have a civilized conversation and then take very wrong decisions either yeah. way.
Sure. I guess that's, yeah.
Well put.
Well, since you're making sense, Franco, why don't you take the next topic?
Okay. Yes, I had a couple of options to talk about. I think I'm just going to cover one because of time. It's not going to be about Spain, sadly. Not that there are not things to talk about Spain, but I guess there's also important things to talk about Latin America. And I guess they're less well known, at least that I have heard. So the main thing is that, or the main result of the thing that I'm going to talk about is that our president, and when I ex president, and when I say ex president, is Peru's ex president from like 10 years ago, is being searched internationally right now with a price over his head. I mean, not literally. They're searching for him.
There's an arrest warrant
in the States. Exactly. Yes. Mm-hmm. There's an arrest warrant with his name because of corruption charges related to this problem. And this has happened like a month ago or less. And the main issue is it's called Odebrecht scandal. Odebrecht is a Brazilian company, a very big engineering company in Brazil. In Brazil, I think all companies in Brazil are big because Brazil is so big that you have to be huge to be able to work for the whole country. And Odebrecht is really big, and it has grown a lot in the past years, and it has projects all over Latin America, also in Spain and in the US, well, everywhere, but mainly in Latin America. And It all started with the Brazilian corruption scandal of Petrobras a couple of years ago, and during this investigation, they arrested the president of this company because of corruption charges regarding politicians in Brazil. And of course, this was a really huge scandal, and it's still going on in Brazil. But at the same time, at the end of last year, I mean, 3 months ago. An investigation that came out of this investigation related how this company had not only had these problems in Brazil but all over Latin America, and so I was looking, and then it's like 10 countries or so, almost the whole continent has some problem related to corruption and involved politicians receiving bribes from this company. And so this company is mainly does construction, big construction projects. So it's they, for example, did in Peru a highway that connects that goes from Brazil to Peru's coast in the Pacific. So it's a huge highway that took like 5 years to build. They did this, and they also did, for example, the first metro line in Lima that's working since 5 years ago.
Sorry to interrupt. Sorry. I have a question, actually. It's really interesting because I think one thing I didn't mention for our French issue with our Republican candidate being accused of illegal activities is that I think 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, what he did, which was give a job to a friend, basically, it wouldn't have been considered so bad that he would need to, it would be a huge scandal. And today it is. And I think it's because people in France are sort of getting better about these things, and we're going the way of the Scandinavians, you know, where if you use government money to buy a burger, then you have to resign. And in France, those things were kind of commonplace. And now, for some reason, I think Fillon is looking at what's happening and he's like, what the hell? This was has never been a problem. We were always like, because everyone in France does a little bit of things on the side. Like everyone tries to get a ticket canceled or to scrape a little bit of money off of their income tax. And so we
or
get,
hire a campaigner through the EU instead of paying for
example,
themselves.
For example. certainly Marine
yeah,
Le Pen
think,
is
yeah,
not.
I think but so each country yeah. has its own standards. Of course,
so
Peru's
my question
standards
is,
are not French ones.
But yet. So I guess my question is, is this symptomatic of a change in the attitude in Peru? We're seeing this in Romania with huge protests against corruption, where I think people are like, what's happening? Why is this a problem now? Is that something that wouldn't have happened before in Peru, or is it different?
Yeah, I think, I don't know, but yeah, I understand what you're saying. And I guess that's the optimist way of seeing at the problem is that now, before it happened, but now we're finding out and really getting to do something about it. It's hard to say because in this case it's obvious. It's like from this highway 20 million went to or they say at least the investigations show that 20 million went to this president or somehow managed to arrive to people related to him. So I mean this one is particularly bad. I'm not sure if in the past we would have found out. So I think that it depends on how you want to see it. It's good that we have. I mean, not only in Peru, but in the rest of the Latin America also, that we are taking it seriously and finding out what's happening with the money we spend on infrastructure. But it's hard to say if this is just we are getting better at catching them, or this has always been like this, and it's just another day in Peru.
But if it's always been like this, and you mean people, I guess my question is, if you had this kind of issue 10 years ago, would people have been that upset? Would there have been this much of an investigation? And, you know, would it have made that
yes,
much noise?
Yes, I mean, okay, yeah, right. we have had, it's hard to compare, but we have had plenty of scandals. Especially after Alberto Fujimori's end of shift in 2000s, there's been more, yeah, three or four really big scandals regarding government and industry and the buying of I mean, this is not I'm not going to say this is fine, but I think this is not the worst we have seen in the last 15 years. Yeah, the past scandals involved buying the press and buying almost everyone just to, yeah, it's, I mean, for Peruvian standards, it's not the worst we've seen, but at least this, maybe in Latin America as a whole, this is a huge thing because it's just one company and it's so many countries involved and so many. So the investigation is logistically big, I would say, and it's not as if we're we have this president in jail already, Fujimori, like, right, and we're getting the next one in jail, and it's not this one also, and it's what this is not the only president that's being judged, because this issue, this scandal involves also the other two presidents we have had.
So what's the sentiment of the population? I know you don't live there, but can you estimate the sentiment of the population with this? Is it like, could it be that the next Trump or whoever shows up and is like, well, F everyone, and, you know, I'm going to throw all of this in the toilet, and even though he might be abrasive, he could get, you know, how fed up are people?
Yeah, the thing is, I think that it's a mixture between being mad and just being, okay, this is politics as it always has been, which I think is even worse, to just resign to what the government is doing. I do hope, not think, that we have had our share of of populist governments in the 80s and 90s.
The memory is more present.
Yes, so I think I would like to think that we have learned, at least from for a generation, we have learned our lesson, and we are not going that way yet. But yeah, having Trump elected and having, for example, Marine Le Pen, if she comes elected, it's not a good example, of course. And I've been thinking about this because in these past years in Latin America, I mean, when I say past years, it's like 2 or 3 maybe. Several populist governments have changed into more, I don't know if liberal is the word, but more normal or non-populist governments. And it's funny or curious how the trend has inversed between US and Latin America, because we have always been the ones where we have these populist governments like Chavez or the Kirchners in Argentina, or I don't know, Correa in Ecuador, or I don't know, there's plenty of examples. Fujimori in Peru, and then there's many. And these last years, it's not as if everything has changed, but it's as if the trend is going one way in Latin America, and the other way in the U.S.
That would indicate to me that maybe the underlying trend is anti-incumbency, where places that didn't have populist governments see populist governments getting a rise, and vice versa. Places that have had populist governments see a different trend rising because people are just tired of whatever has been in power not working for them.
Yeah, it seems that way. I think the not working for them is also very relative, because if you look at, you know, the idealized 50s, I think, again, the situation of even poor-ish people today is much better than what the country, you know, people
yeah,
send
I mean,
me...
But you're basically saying you shouldn't be angry, people, because you're absolutely right.
Oh, that's like, not
what
I'm
saying. Term, people are much better, but that doesn't change. It's an emotional response. It's not a logical response.
I guess that's what I'm getting at. It's that, you know, but people feel like everything's going down the drain, and that was the platform of Donald Trump. And I understand that for some people it's not great, but I mean, that's a whole other discussion. Anyway, I didn't want to.
And that was the reason that I wasn't sure about discussing this topic in particular, or just, for example, mentioning the good things that are happening in Peru. I mean, there's good and bad, and I guess we always tend to discuss the bad things because they're so special. But sometimes it's nice to just say, okay, for example, I don't know, Peru hasn't had a really big radical change in government in the last, I don't know, 17 years, which I'm not saying these governments are good, but at least we haven't made really crazy decisions. The education ministry has been doing a good job these last 10 years. I mean, the poverty has been reduced I think it was in 15 years from 30% to, I don't know if it was 20 or something like that. So there's a lot of things to say, I guess. But the good things don't get that much attention, I guess.
And you know, that's something I'm very much guilty of as well. I often say, you know, the reason we're panicking about everything is that we only hear, this is well known, you know, we only report bad news, and the 24 hours news network, of course, they're going to tell you everyone's, you know, everything is exploding everywhere and everyone's dying all the time, when in reality, that's not the case. And here in this show, we're following that natural line of only talking about the bad things. Maybe I should institute.
We are only human. I mean,
if you talk about good things, people get mad at you. They're like, "Oh, Pollyanna. Oh, you just think everything's fine. Live in your little shelter. Pretend the world's great."
All right. Well, I'm sure we're going to move on to Tom, unless you want to add something, Franco.
No, that's okay. Yeah.
Oh, I have actually one more comment on Franco's story. The pursuit of Toledo is part of another trend that I don't think gets as much attention, which is anti-corruption. And And that's happening in Brazil. It's happening in Korea. It's happening in China. And those are all different situations. I'm not trying to compare them all, but they are all have the commonality of there is a use of anti-corruption in pursuing power, in changing power. It's interesting.
You know, it's happening in France. This what happened with Fillon, the scandal, I'm certain it wouldn't have happened before. And that's a smaller sign because we're not, you know, we're not Italy. We're not like barbarians. but it's happening in Romania. There, of course, I'm sure you've heard of the huge protests there. And the interesting thing is that Putin, of all people, for his many, many faults, and he's definitely a populist and definitely, you know, he controls the press. Huge problems. But one of his strongest qualities is that he's very much anti-corruption, and he's trying to rein in and control the pervasive corruption in the system that has been built up after an incredibly corrupt communist government. And so maybe, you know,
I would argue that he just centralizes corruption. He's just monopolizing it. He's not really.
You know, I think we're looking at it, and I think it would be very interesting to have a conversation with actual Russians. Note for later. I think we're looking at it from our perspective. It's not as easy as having Putin come in and be like, all right, corruption's over now. You can't be corrupted and everything's better. Sure. And I'm not saying he's a fantastic human being. I think, again, many, many faults. But I really think that he cares about this and he cares about his country. And that's why he's so popular. Many people say, he rigs the elections and blah, 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 and the media. And certainly that's true. But I think everyone agrees that even if none of this happened, he probably would still win the elections. Probably. And that would be worth diving into. But
I don't know. If you control the press, then there's nothing that the people know. I mean, that what the people
that's
know
very
doesn't,
new.
doesn't relate to what the government is doing. I'm not. It's hard for me to believe that he's so transparent, and that's why he controls
everyone
the press.
Everyone knows. It's like Trump. Everyone knows. It's not like, you know, he's Kim Jong-un and he's sheltering the country from the reality of reality. Everyone knows what's happening. Everyone knows he controls the press, and everyone knows that they're probably not going to be saying. It's not like state-sponsored media. They're still relative. They shouldn't rock the boat, but it was interesting. I was there and we watched a debate between the Russians and people discussing the issue of Ukraine. And the Russians were like in suits with ties, looking really great. And the Ukrainians were a little bit, you know, funny looking. They had weird like pants and like they didn't look as tight. And it's not that the debates don't happen. You know, it's not that kind of environment. It's not that discussion. It's not Trump jumping in a puddle and saying you're fake news. You shouldn't exist. Basically, which is, you know, we can discuss this. It does kind of still take place, but I'm fairly certain that many of the... I mean, Russia is a fascinating country, and I've been learning a lot more about it. And I think, again, people don't understand Russia, and it's really difficult to say, well, they're being lied to, and Putin controls everything, when the context is so different, and that's not exactly how it actually is. It's kind of how it is, but not exactly. And when we're saying, oh, but they can't make informed decisions, I think we understand something different from the reality of that country. And I don't know too much, so maybe I'm sort of misunderstanding it as well. But corruption.
They got to
sucks.
Patrick.
They got to me. I was there for a week, and now look what I'm saying. I'm defending Russia. For the record,
the press.
I was actually worried going in there, and I was like, holy crap, what's going to happen? You know, I say bad things about Putin on Twitter. Are they going to look at this? And like, of course, I wasn't actually.
It's not the United States, Patrick. Of course it's not.
You know, that you're saying in jokingly. But I'm probably going to go to the US this year, and I'm uneasy. I'm actually, you know, and I understand this is irrational and this is, but, you know, I was born in Lebanon. I'm actually, I don't know. I'm not saying nice things about Trump. And I know that there's a whole portion of the listening population listening to this and saying, oh my God, Patrick, come on. Like, what are you saying? This is ridiculous. It's not, though. I assure you it's not. This sentiment means something. And it's not... I hope you know me by now enough to know that I'm not falling prey to the ridiculousness of, you know, Rachel Maddow and Keith, what's his name, Olbermann, like the clowns from the left side. I understand there is this psychosis on the left side as well, but that's not what it is about. It's actually concerning. Anyway, all right. Since we started talking about it, Tom... I've really been looking forward to this portion of the show because, as I alluded to at the beginning, you are, I think the way I can put it best is, in my opinion, you are neutral to a fault, the way I look at it. Like, you try to see all sides of everything to a point where I think neutrality and objectivity are different. And objectivity is you look at things as, you know, objectively as possible. And when they're bad, then you say, well, yes, this is bad. And the way I look at you is that you try to be objective so much that you tend to overcompensate in the other side and try to stay neutral and say, well, nothing is really bad. And, you know, I'm obviously making a very exaggerated description, but my point is, what you think of situations, I really take to heart because you're the most neutral person I know, and it often gives me a guiding light for how I should look at a situation, and it shines a different light on the situation, which I find almost nowhere else. So with that introduction, what's been happening in the US, Tom?
Well, a local trade association here in Los Angeles had a meeting yesterday, and they had a big scandal over announcing the wrong winner of one of their awards. But I guess you don't want to talk about the Oscars.
That was funny, though. I woke up today and saw that, and it made me laugh. So maybe, well, laugh and cry. But yeah, no, let's not make that the main topic.
No, of course not. You know, I like that you use the word neutral because I definitely have my own beliefs. But when I discuss things and when I evaluate things, I try very hard to correct for my own biases. And that, I feel like, neutral is a good word. I try to approach things neutrally and say, okay, Tom, you tend to want to think this, but let's look at it from the other side and see if your you know, thought is still rational. Let's test that. Objectivity, I don't think, is really possible because of that. We all have our biases. We can strive for objectivity, but I don't think any of us can achieve it. So I really do like your choice of neutrality there. That doesn't mean that I personally am neutral. I'm very much not, but I strive very hard to approach topics and evaluate them with the idea of, okay, maybe I tend to want to think this, but is there a rational reason to think the other side? Because I think we all overvalue how right we are all the time. I know I do. And so I try to correct for that. And so with this election, I and with the inauguration of the president, I think we are, as a society here in the United States, moving the other direction, digging in and saying, well, I have to fight against the other side. And the trick is, if you're on either side of this debate, you're not going to persuade anyone with that attitude of you're all idiots. And you kind of touched on this earlier in the show when you were talking about the French situation. Just because someone supported the candidate that you didn't like, or just because someone supports the president and you don't, or vice versa, doesn't mean they're idiots. If you look at the, you know, 40 to 50 million people that voted for each candidate in the U.S. election, certainly some of them are idiots, but it would be statistically unlikely that the majority of them are. So what what I think is more productive is saying, okay, why don't you support the president? Are you I'm not going to jump to the conclusion that you're unpatriotic and unrealistic and weak. Or why do you support the president? I'm not going to jump to the conclusion that you're a racist bigot who wants to see the world, you know, burn in flames. So why do you have this difference? And that's what I think we're missing in the discussion, because a lot of people have dug in and said, well, if you even try to understand the other side, you're a traitor to our side.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And that's a sentiment that I'm feeling here increasingly in France. That being said, what's been happening in the US in the past month, while steering clear of, you know, words like traitor and those kinds of sentiments, I think last episode we talked about worries and concerns and sort of different levels of looking at a situation and thinking it's not good. Are you worried? Are you concerned? The way in which President Trump has been talking about the press, for example, sort of inciting hatred towards the press, which is essentially a counterpower, which is really important to democracy, I don't really understand how you can look at it and say, well, you know, he has his reasons. I mean, I'm sure he does, but this seems like something to be worried about.
When we talked last time, it was a lot of like, well, he says this or she says this. What are they really going to do if they get in office? And now we're being able to see some of the things that they actually do when they get in office. I would say if you really want to evaluate, you need to evaluate actions, not words. And this is one of those really important things in doing what I said about listening to the other side and trying to understand them. What people who oppose the president do is read him on Twitter and react. And that is not the message that people who support the president pay attention to. They dismiss that. They say, you know what? That's him tweaking you. And maybe it's strategic. Maybe it's a personality flaw. I don't know. But when you listen to President Trump speak to his supporters, and not in sound bites, but like in full interviews, he sounds very reasonable in his tone. You may not disagree. You may agree or disagree with what he's actually saying, but he doesn't talk in all caps. And he makes exceptions. He says, a lot of the media are against me, right? And so when he writes in 140 characters, it's the media are the enemy of the people, which is a ridiculous thing to say. However, when he talks, when he talks to the people who are spending the time listening to him all the time, he says, well, of course we have, you know, Breitbart and Fox News and people who are doing a great job out there. It's the New York Times that's the problem. So this is a really important distinction. Well, hold on. Let me finish. This is a really important distinction because he is trying to drive the opposition into looking like they are less credible to the people in the middle who might be persuaded by them. Or if he's not trying to, that seems to be the effect of what he's doing.
But already you're sort of explaining the difference here, and he's saying, well, basically those that agree with me are fine, the others are the enemy of the people. I'm not sure that's much better. And I think if Obama had started saying Fox News is the enemy of the people, it wouldn't have been okay either. So I don't see.
Okay. Yes, it's not okay. But is it the worst thing that he's done? Is it an actual policy position? What is the effect of having doing it?
I can write a full list.
This is where it's frustrating. Is that if you are already in opposition to the president, then you say yes. You know, I want another reason to put in front. And honestly, if you look at what he has done, it is more useful and less polarizing. Because if I'm a supporter of the president, I'm going to argue with you about, well, he didn't really mean it. And so he said some things, you snowflakes, he can't say anything without, you know, really getting you upset. Sorry, you're so sensitive.
He's the snowflake.
Whereas
at the
if
moment.
We actually talk about the incompetent executive order, if we actually talk about the fact that if he wanted to do extreme vetting, he could have done what President Obama did and actually create extreme vetting without causing a problem with the courts. If he had actually let his staff review the executive order, he wouldn't have had the trouble in the courts that he had. That, I think, is more understandable to people who voted for Obama and voted for Trump. It's something we can all look at and say, okay, that's, you know, you can't argue your way out of this. You can't say you didn't mean it. You wrote this order and you put it out there. If you look at the executive order limiting lobbying, you can say, hey, you know what? He did a pretty good thing here. He said that if you work for the government for 5 years after you work for the government, you can't go work in a lobbying organization that lobbies that department you worked in. And so this is the kind of thing I'm talking about, is a lot of this, whether it's by design or not, is trying to get us to argue about something that doesn't have as much relevance as the actual actions that are being done. And yeah. and one of those actions is changing the nature of the National Security Council. That is not being discussed nearly enough. That is a very significant development.
I think it's the problem is everything is being discussed, and maybe some of it of substance is being lost in the conversation because there are these outrageous tweets, really, that's what it is. But the Security Council has been discussed at length. And let's talk about this, maybe. How, you know, again, in your neutral pedestal tower of righteousness, how do you...
now you call me self-righteous. I feel bad.
No. I'm actually saying you are... It's not self-righteous. I'm calling you righteous. I'm not saying you're self-righteous. So it's a compliment. No, I mean, I actually mean it. When you try to look at it in the neutral way that you do, don't some of these things actually worry you as well? Like the National Security Council issues, the constant... I mean, the leaks, it's always difficult to discuss because you're going to say, well, it's leaks, it's people who don't like it, and so they're trying to... But still, there are so many, and there are so many issues... I don't know. What basically I'm trying to ask you, I think, what do you think of this government so far?
Yeah, I don't think that it has shown itself to be a great government so far. I don't think it is as bad as some of the people are saying. And I think that really the deciding voice of the future of the country is the people who voted for Obama and also voted for Trump. And those people are not going to be persuaded by a Twitter fight. Those people are not going to pay that much attention to the president's tweets. Those people are going to look at what's actually happening in the country, especially what's happening to them. And so it's
so what you're saying is it's too early?
And here's the other thing I try to do is say, when previous presidents have done these things in a less controversial and braggadocious way, what was the reaction then? And so I look at something like Russia, the accusations of Russia, and there's a big fog there. I can't actually tell what's going on because Russia has become the left's Benghazi. You just throw it out there all the time, and it's hard to actually tell if there's fire where there's smoke, right? So that's one that I'm keeping an eye on. I'm very curious, and I think it could turn into something, but at this point, it's very difficult to tell. But the actual actions of the president are what you can look at, the actual orders, the actual policies that are being implemented. And there are some very concerning things there. Some of the things that a lot on the left are concerned about are things that the presidents before have done. President Bush did, President Reagan did. They're just Republican things like defunding Planned Parenthood. If you disagree with them then, you're going to disagree with them now. It's not a particularly, you know, unique thing for a Republican president to do. Other things like asking for the resignations of all of the ambassadors immediately, not asking them to stay on, to the point that in the current discussions about Syria in Geneva, there is no U.S. representation. That's troubling. That does not seem like someone who actually knows how to run the executive branch to me.
Yeah, so, I was... Can I say a little bit?
Sure, of course. Go ahead.
So I have actually... a couple of things to say. One is yes, you were saying, Tom, judge the actions, not the words. I cannot, it's hard for me to agree with that because so regarding actions, for example, there's two main things that I would think that it's relevant to follow. First is the intentions. So letting aside first the words and just focusing on the actions. is the intention good? I mean, or does it make sense what they want to do? So that's one thing that's a thing to discuss, I guess. And you can be you can agree or not. The other one is incompetence, and I think that it's important to separate both concepts. You can have very good intentions and still be have a very bad government, and I think that they should be judged separately. And people should have a clear idea and an opinion about whether what they want to do in this new government makes sense. And also at the other hand, if what they are actually doing, they're doing it correctly or not. Because, yeah, I don't know. For me, incompetence can be just as dangerous and as bad intentions. You can really ruin a country by just governing badly. The reasons can be many. I have no idea why would a government itself do a worse job than the one before. Maybe improvisation is a cause. Maybe many things can be causes. Maybe a bad design or having just a mixture of things and concepts can make you very bad executioner or person that executes executive. And so that's one thing and I think those two concepts are important to separate. The other one is regarding words and actions. I don't think that you can that the president or whoever in government should be allowed to say whatever he wants, just as long as he does the right thing. I mean, even if the intentions are good in the actions and the government is competent, I don't think that the government should just the government or the president or whoever has the right to just say whatever he wants and then do whatever he chooses to. And I relate a lot to this because this happens everywhere, I guess. A politician just promises whatever he wants in the campaign, and then at the end he just does whatever he wants. And in Peru this happens like regularly. Like there's even a phrase, and it's more translated, it's like he stole but at least he did something. Like he stealed, but at least he did something, and it's just like I don't care what the politician says or the government says, yeah, as long as he does things that are good to me, because language is important, and being able to just get away with it is not healthy for a society, right?
But for
because
the,
it's
the aspect of, you know, people say something and then do something else. I think everyone, and especially people who voted for Trump, are going to say, well, this is exactly the problem. And Trump, you know, he might not do everything, but he's already done a lot of the things that he said he would. So that's a good thing. What I can relate to is he shouldn't be allowed to say anything he wants. Obviously, it's difficult to put in place, but I kind of steer your way, Franco, when you're saying that, because the president has a responsibility, and not verbally destroying basically the fourth estate, or the third estate, by the way, is it the third or the second when he started attacking the judicial?
Mm.
I understand it's just words and it's just Twitter and we can say all of this, but even if we're trying to stay rational and neutral and everything, the president has a huge responsibility. He has a huge power, and what he says, his word matters. And I don't know if you guys remember, but when we were discussing after the election, I think I was very vehement in saying that, you know, now he's the president, maybe he's going to be presidential and maybe he's going to change, we should wait and see. And when he's saying those things, when he's saying judges are, you know, judges suck and the press is the enemy of the people, I understand it's just words, but he has power. And with that power, as we all well know since Spider-Man 1, with that great power comes great responsibility. So again, I'm not saying we should, you know, there should be a provision in the Constitution that says the president shouldn't tweet, but at least we can look at it and say, yes, this is a concern and this is a problem when he says those things, and not, you know, well, but it's just words, whatever, right?
Well, again, I think you guys are absolutely right. You have the right to look at someone and say, I don't like what they're saying. I think it's irresponsible in their position of power. But do you want to have that battle? or do you want to have a different battle? And if what we're talking about
is... You want to have all the battles.
I want to get the president out, then that maybe that is the battle you want to have. I don't know. If your battle is, I actually want to have a good government, and I want to engage in a dialogue with people who maybe don't agree entirely with me, but... again, voted for Obama and voted for Trump and understand them, then focusing on those tweets isn't going to be your best option. So this is different than saying approve of the tweets. It's different than saying it's okay that he says these things. It's saying you're not going to make a lot of progress having that argument. And in fact, it may be what that the right wing wants is for you to spend all your time arguing about the meaning of words rather than having a more substantive discussion about the actions.
I think those words are very wise and I approve of them.
Of course I agree you need to be practical and focus on the higher risks, let's say, and the higher risks are of course on the implementations and the way the laws are going to be written, right?
Yeah. In a certain sense, if someone constantly says shocking things and you've decided, like, okay, that's a person who says inappropriate things, do you need to keep proving that point? And if you keep engaging every time they say shocking things, are you maybe not encouraging them to continue to say shocking things because they like your reaction?
And especially considering the fact that the people who voted for him...
shut up, Siri.
Every time.
That is the only way to shut up Siri, though. Absolutely.
I agree. I lost my point. No, the people who did vote for him acknowledge that he says shocking things. I think that's the thing that, you know, for people who are shocked, it's like, but how did you, and our heads explode every time. And the people on the other side are saying, yeah, we know he's an idiot. Or, you know, maybe not he's an idiot, but
he says crazy things.
He says
we get
crazy
it.
Things.
But we think he's going to change things for the better
exactly.
anyway.
So saying, coming back to the, but he said something crazy.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, we told you, we know. And you're like, but it's really crazy. And so I understand that dynamic. And I think the most ironic part of all of this is that I've been trying to convince people in this election that we should listen to the people who are voting for the far right, because if for no other reason that when we've tried to call them homophobes and racists and yell at them, it's never worked in France, it's never worked in the UK, and it's never worked in the US. So if we keep doing it, then who's the idiot? Right. If we keep doing the thing that doesn't work and makes the situation worse, regardless of everything else, who's the idiot in that story? And I guess, you know, I'm calling myself an idiot right now because I keep doing that thing that doesn't work and that serves no purpose, which is getting aggravated by the tweets and those kinds of things from Donald Trump. So, as always, it's an interesting, you know, way of looking at things when we discuss it.
But
who disagree.
But besides being scandalized by the tweets, I think I agree. There's got to be a better way of learning by mistake or just learning a lesson of that. And I think that the lesson should be: do not assume that crazy people just say crazy things before the elections and they're going to do what's right at the end when they become president. I think that the lesson is do not trust people that do crazy things in general. Because part of the argument we have discussed, and it's been discussed many times, is yeah, he does he writes really extreme things, but then he'll do what's right when he gets president.
Or no, I
he, yes, he writes know, crazy things, and so the lesson I think should be don't just assume that it's part of the personality. And then this is a normal thing because
I don't think anyone's assuming that Trump is going to do great, including people who voted for him. And I think that might be one of the disconnects. Whenever I have a conversation with someone who's, you know, willing to, quote unquote, give him the benefit of the doubt, which infuriates people on my side of the political spectrum when people say that. But if you take the previous episode, for example, people were discussing, you know, Brian and Tony were discussing that Muslim ban, I think, in a relatively calm and rational manner. We might have disagreed ultimately on whether or not it was good or bad, it was a very different substance for the conversation than what we usually discuss when we talk essentially of the tweets. So I don't think what the conclusion of this discussion is, well, he says crazy things, so it's crazy, but we should be okay with everything. I think the conclusion is, let's not waste time talking about the tweets, and let's talk about the actual policies being put in place, like the Muslim ban, which we can have a substantial conversation about, and, you know, the other policies. And maybe that's something we're not doing enough here. And
yeah,
I think it's something we're not doing enough, partly because that's something that the media circus is not discussing enough.
Yes. And some of what the criticisms of the media are valid. Some of the criticisms of the media are very true and have been made by people on the left as well as the right. It's not that the media is blameless. Again, it's a matter of degree. And so when there's criticisms of the media, on the one hand, I feel like that's fair. The media gets things wrong. Oftentimes they're lazy. Oftentimes they do let their biases creep in what they choose to report on. On the other hand, saying that you're looking for a friendly question in a press conference is troubling to me, because when you are a public servant, which I believe the elected officials are, part of that is having to listen to questions you don't like. They don't necessarily going to be friendly questions. You don't have to answer them if you don't want to. You don't even have to let CNN into your gaggle if you don't want to. That is the system working. There is freedom of the press. The press gets to say what they want. They get to ask what they want. You as an executive can choose to react to that how you want. And I think one of the issues is we've had no real tests of our democratic system in the U.S. since Richard Nixon. And so we've gotten used to things just kind of working without having to put the system of checks and balances to the test. And this president is pushing the system in some ways that are not constitutional, where it's like he's not violating the Constitution by kicking CNN out of a press briefing with his press secretary. But that's pushing the sort of soft system that we have developed. And what you have to do is react to that and say, OK, well, if you're not going to let us in, this is what's going to happen. And the reason people have let us in the past is because they knew this was going to happen. So now this is what the consequences of that are going to be. And then some of them are constitutional, where you put an executive order out that is poorly drafted and it gets tested in the court. And you can complain that you don't like what the judge did, but that doesn't mean it's not the system working. We have a system where judges are appointed for a reason. Judges are appointed to adjudicate when people disagree about how laws are being drafted or executed. Congress makes the laws that the judge interprets, and the executive branch executes the laws, and the judge can judge whether those laws are being executed properly. Again, we're not used to the system having to work in that way, but it is. And so when people get so upset, and Brian Brushwood, my friend, says this all the time, the president of the United States is not a God king. He or she cannot do everything they want. And we're seeing that. We're seeing that play out. What will be very troubling is if methods are taken to undermine that. So far, that hasn't happened.
Yeah, I think the main thing that U.S. has is it's good institutions and really good history of a lot of time of building institutions, and of course I think Europe has it too, and that just I see it as a as a way of resisting any really bad government. I mean, that's the reason for the institutions is so the country can be immune to a really extreme, be it party or government or anything. And I think that I do agree that the U.S. will do just fine in 4 years. Maybe what worries me most is the trend. Because, yeah, if it's 4 years, yeah, probably nothing really bad will happen, or hopefully. But the thing is, what if this becomes a trend? Because then I would argue, then you become maybe Venezuela or something. If you give 15 years or 20 years to a government, to a really populist government, to do whatever they want, yeah, the institutions will protect the actual state of the country, or
the balance of power and the adversarial process, mm-hmm. and yeah,
the consistency. Yeah, yeah.
It's like inertia, and then to break it requires just a lot of force and a lot of time. But eventually, you can really break institutions. You just need a lot of time or a really really bad precedent.
So I think the conclusion of all of this is that let's worry less about the tweets, and let's. I hope that people agree that with this ousting of, you know, CNN and everyone from, you know, the media that don't agree with the administration of the gaggle, that's fine. I think everyone, you know, it's
President Obama stopped talking to Fox News for a while. This is, you know, presidents try this from time to time.
Yeah. And I think it's fine. What we have to be careful about what happens next. And you're right, Tom. This is the system being put to the test in a way that it hasn't been in a long time. And that's why the system is designed that way. But I think it's also okay to look at this and get a little bit tense, you know, and go, okay, so is it going to work? Because we haven't used it in a while. And we have to keep paying attention. And if it doesn't work, then, you know, we have to also be able to talk about it and keep in mind with rationality, with, you know, without having our heads explode every 2 seconds, but keep in mind what Franco is talking about, that those things can lead to concerning situations. So if we can keep all of this rational, it's better than if our heads explode. And that, I'm not going to make this the title of the episode, but it
could. I like it though.
All right. I think this was a really good conversation, and I thank both of you for taking part. Is there anything you want to say before we close it and before I give you the opportunity to tell us where we can find you on the internet? Any parting words?
I would just, again, try to say, look, you may disagree about levels of taxation or FCC policy or immigration policy. Try to separate that from really troubling changes. What is just a Republican administration doing what a Republican administration does that maybe you think is awesome or maybe you don't? And what are things that are unique? I think this president does some unique things, and those are the things that you really need to separate and not just attack everything because it's different than how you would want it done.
I've spent a few days saying being against gay marriage in France, which was passed. However, for it, I am personally being against it is not illegal. Being anti-abortion is also not illegal. I think it's a very important women's right, but, you know, and those kinds of things. And I think in France as well, the debate is getting muddied because people say, you know, things like, oh, they want to ban abortion, which I agree. It's anyway.
I mean, you want to change open internet guidelines? Let's have a conversation. You want to change the rules on voting? You have to show me that there's a real problem first. Mm. That's a much different situation.
Yeah. And I mean, in the abortion thing, I think it might be a bad example because I think it's anyway, that would be a whole different conversation. But yes, like let's have conversations about the actual policies and the things that matter, not tweets, while keeping an eye on those things as well. Franco, anything you want to say before we close it?
Yeah, just following what you were saying about focusing on some things and not in others, I would say don't focus that much on Trump only. There's a lot of things going on in the world and also in the US, and they are also very important. And we shouldn't just focus on one person because there's many horrible and very good things happening, and they probably are also worth the time and the conversation.
Like Bannon, or who are you talking about?
Or like Syria, or yeah, exactly. Somalia, like, or yeah.
there was an awesome interview with Assad for French media a week or two ago. It was masterful the way he spun everything and made it sound like everything was fine. It was incredible. It's in English if you can find it somewhere. It's like, yeah, he's not so bad. Like, dictatorships are fine. What's the big deal? It was, and that is also something I keep in mind. Anyway, that also would be another episode that would be interesting to do and things to discuss. So many things we have to talk about and so little time. But you know what? We are able to discuss many of them because the people supporting the show are supporting the show. On Patreon, we have many supporters which make this production, this getting meeting of the minds possible. And if you enjoy it, if you think it should exist, then I encourage you to go to patreon.com/thephileasclub. The link is in the show notes, of course. And maybe consider, you know, pledging a little bit of money, because that's how the world works, people. It's not socialism. It's not communism yet. It's money. And if you give me money, I'll keep doing the show. That's the deal we have. So thank you very much to all of the people who do support the show. It's really, really appreciated. And if you want to become part of that amazing club, then go to patreon.com/thephileasclub. Tom, where can people find you on the internet?
TomMerritt.com, 2 R's, 2 T's, is where I collect everything I do together. And just a special mention that I have a novel coming out March 14th, which you can pre-order on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, about a time traveler who tries to save the universe. It's called Pilot X.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Franco, I think you didn't have a Twitter or online presence last time. Has this changed?
No, I'm really antisocial in that sense.
But will you know what President Trump is tweeting? I guess you can go to the tweet page and look at it.
I just go to the street and I just listen to people talking about it. Yeah. It's not that hard.
Fair enough. All right. Well,
yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I think I have a Google Plus account. I still have it, although I don't know if that makes much of a difference. Yeah.
Well, send me the link in Skype, and I'll include it in the show notes. I'll do that.
Okay, sure.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Tom. Thank you very much, Franco. For me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter and on Facebook. You can join the Facebook page as well. And the show is hosted at FrenchSpin.com, where you can go and comment on everything we've discussed, whether you agree or disagree. The comments are usually incredibly polite and, you know, cordial. The community around this show is, I always say that, you know, you reap what you sow, right? And
yes.
The people getting, that's the expression, the people getting trolls in their community are often the people just being comfortable yelling at everything. And hopefully the substance and the nature of the show fosters a positive but also cordial community. So if you want to comment, it's at FrenchSpin.com, and you'll find a gaming show there as well. So if you're into that, you can check that out too. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back for the next episode soonish. Talk to you then. Bye.